listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Now, on to our protagonist in Queen of America, the beloved healer and spiritual leader known as the Mexican Joan of Arc. It seems that she shares the same courage, persistence, and curiosity as her great-nephew, tonight's esteemed guest. After 2 decades of research into historical records and family history, Luis valiantly crafted the tale of Teresita's life in 19th century Mexico in the prequel, The Hummingbird's Daughter. But her journey was far from complete, and Queen of America writes the young and impressionable Teresita into American history as she travels from Mexico to America during the time of the Mexican Revolution. This magical, rich, picaresque novel puts Urrea's readers, quote, into the dream. Luis Alberto Urrea was born in Tijuana, Mexico, to a Mexican father and an American mother. He is the author of 13 books and a member of the Latino Literature Hall of Fame. The Devil's Highway, his nonfiction work about the harrowing journey of immigrants crossing into southern Arizona, was a finalist for the 2005 Pulitzer Prize. Prior to his prolific career as a writer, Luis served as a relief worker in Tijuana and a columnist, editor, cartoonist for numerous publications. His dual culture life experiences lead him to explore greater themes of love, loss, and triumph, as well as giving him a deep understanding of the complex challenges of the borderlands. In conversation with our author is Carolyn Kellogg, an award-winning staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, where she writes book reviews and covers the publishing world. Her writing has appeared in several anthologies, and she recently wrote The Poets and Writers Guide to Literary Los Angeles. Please welcome me in welcoming our authors tonight.
Buenas tardes. So I'm supposed to start this with some reading, and then we'll chat. Hummingbird's Daughter was a life changer for me, and I always intended it to be 2 stories, and so Queen of America is part 2. We'll be talking about that here, so I won't belabor it much. I will tell you a little bit about the part I'm going to share with you, just to sort of set the stage, but Teresita came to the United States, and they traveled around a lot. I'm sure we'll cover that. But at one point, Teresita and her family lived in Clifton, Arizona, and she fell in love. She fell in love with a guy named Lupe Rodriguez. And her father, like many of our Mexican dads, did not approve of the boyfriend. And he was really against this and thought there was no way he was going to give his blessing to this relationship. And the scene that I'm going to do for you is where Tomás has fought with Teresita so much that the women folk have turned against him. And those of you who had Mexican dads know, I think one thing we can't take is the silent treatment. And he would come home and the women wouldn't talk to him, and he would enter a room and they would look at their nails and stop talking, and they stopped serving him and stopped cooking for him, and he just couldn't take it anymore. So one morning, he decides he's going to go out to the bunkhouse and have breakfast with his vaqueros, or as they called them in Arizona, his buckaroos. And that's how this scene transpires, that morning when he goes out. And in honor of this evening, I'll do it for you from memory instead of using the book. Tomás Urrea left the house and walked across the field to his bunkhouse, thinking, I will have breakfast with the vaqueros this morning. He opened the door and he said, muchachos! And they said, ¿qué pasa, jefe? He said, muchachos, would you mind if I joined you for breakfast this morning? They said, sure thing, jefe, sit down. He sat at the end of the table. They all scooted down. The cook took out a tin plate and slid it down the table to him. It was full of a steaming mass that looked like a boiled clot of blood. It was red and pink and smelled a little strange, and he said, "My good man, what is this wonderful dish?" And the cook said, "Why, Heffy, that there's pooch." He said, "Ah, pooch, guess pooch." He said, "Well, that's stale biscuits and some old hard bread. We boil it up with old tomatoes. You put some sugar on that. That's some real good eating, Heffy." Tomas said, "That's wonderful. Would you excuse me one second? I'll be right back." He stepped out on the porch and began to run. He ran back to the house thinking, "I know what I can do so the women will feed me again. I will give them a fiesta. I'll give them an old-style Mexican baile, and they will all love me." The night of the baile, the dance floor was outside. The trees were hung with paper lanterns. Banners and papel picado flags hung from crossed ropes. Barbacoa was cooking. There was a beef here, a goat here. On that side, a tub of sweet tamales made with cinnamon, honey, and raisins. A polka band from Safford, Arizona, played in one corner. Tuba, violin, bajo sexto, guitarra. The guitarists went up and down like the pistons of some meat engine as they played polkas, and the dancers stomped in circles, looking like the two halves of horses that had been sawn in half and were galloping. Teresita came into the party with her taciturn lover, Lupe Rodriguez. He was tall in his finest black suit. She had her arm through his, and she said, "Ay, Lupe, mira, this just fills my heart." And he said, "I have no heart." She said, "No, Lupe, no. What you're supposed to do is say something nice, something beautiful, like, Teresita, I have no heart because your beauty has lifted my spirit out of my body." And Lupe said, "I have no spirit." She thought he was macho, but she would teach him how to talk to a woman. Then here came Tomas Urrea, making his entrance. He was riding his finest black stallion, Caballito Urrea. He had named every animal on the ranch after himself. There was Caballito Urrea. The bull was Toro Urrea. They even had a green parrot that was called Periquito Urrea. Periquito Urrea spent the day in his cage saying, "Periquito, Periquito, Periquito." People said he was an egomaniac. Tomas was dressed all in black, tight black pants, little notch cut in the back to fit his gut, but tight. He had silver medallions sewn up the outer seams of his pants. He had a belt with silver conchas, a twin pistola gun belt with the butts pointing out for cross draw in case he needed to kill anyone. A white frilled top with a tight, short, black jacket cut to his waist with red roses embroidered at the back, at the breast, and on the back, a black silk scorpion. Upon his head, a vast black sombrero worked with silver threads, with two silver horseshoes on the crown. As he came in, the horse began to bob its head to the music. It began to move sideways, moved the other way sideways, moved its feet in rhythm, and people said, "Mira el jefe, he's so powerful, even his horse dances." Tomas pulled the horse to a stop, kicked his leg over the pommel, flew off the side of the horse with his arms raised, took off the hat, dropped it on the head of a little boy. It went down over the little boy's ears, and Tomas said, "It is good to be king, my friend." He walked into the middle of the dance floor. The music stopped. The dancer stopped. Everyone looked at him. He stood there. He raised his hand, snapped his fingers, and as if by magic, a coil of rope appeared in his hand. At the end of the rope, a lasso. He dropped the lasso on the ground and began to spin it slowly. It stirred on the ground, lifted an inch above the ground, hovered in midair. He brought it up sideways so it formed an oval portal in the universe next to him through which anything might pass. He looked across the dance floor and saw a group of girls sitting in chairs. He sent the loop toward them. They screamed and ran, knocking over their chairs. He brought the thing back, passed it over himself like a wave in the ocean. The girls came back. He sent it back at them, charged them away again. And at this moment, the magic thing happened. At this moment, with one flick of the wrist, he spun it up above his head. It formed a hemp tornado with a perfect round mouth. He didn't look. He was macho. To be macho means you've already done everything. You've done it so much, you're bored. Stood like this. Teresita was staring at him, and he looked at her, and he dropped the rope over her shoulders and cinched her tight. Everybody laughed. Everybody applauded. He pulled her. She pulled back. He pulled her. She pulled back. He hand over hand pulled her toward him. When she broke, ran laughing into his arms. He hugged her, spun her in a circle, and said, "Stay away from that bastard." He took the rope off her, and she ran back to Lupe. People went crazy. They applauded. They cheered him. Somebody ran up to him with a copa of tequila, and he said, "Viva Mexico!" He drank it. Somebody else ran up to him with a flagon of beer. He looked at it and said, "Long live America!" And he drank the beer. Somebody stopped him with a glass of vino, and he said, "God bless Arizona!" And he drank that. He walked to his horse to make his exit, but before he left, he turned back to the audience, raised his hands as though he himself were the saint of Cabora, and he said, "How'd you like that, cabrones?" Thank you. Salud.
God, that's so loud. I'm so sorry.
I know.
So, Tomas is macho, and he's
macho.
He sort of rules his domain, but that domain, since the hummingbird's daughter, has changed significantly. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about where they start.
Tomas has come from being a powerful hacienda master to, being decimated and destroyed in Mexico and cast out of his country. And he's come to America and really can't find his way. He can't find his way to get back to what he left behind to come here, which is something torn directly from my own life. You know, my father was on the presidential staff of Mexico. He was a captain in the Mexican army, and he was given orders to execute somebody that he wouldn't execute. Then he was under a death threat himself. And he moved to Tijuana and from Mexico City. And then when he came to the United States, my dad could never find a way to get back, you know. So he spent most of his life as a janitor, as a custodian at bowling alleys, which is where I spent a lot of my boyhood. And I watched him struggle trying to find a way to have his dignity and to achieve things. And I found a real correlation with Tomas in that. And I think it's an immigrant experience for a lot of the first generation, sort of gateway immigrant people who come. So that's where he's at, I think, when we meet him in this book. And although he is, you know, in some ways macho, he's a man from the 1800s in Mexico, you know, he's an urrea. So we're all kind of clowns in some ways and loquacious characters and all that. But also in an earlier book, a nonfiction book, I once said that I felt that in our families anyway, the women allow the men to consider themselves the kings. And they let us strut around and bellow and do our stupid things and then just wait till we go outside and then actually run the world. And I think that's what's happening to him.
And when Teresita, and I'm not sure what to call her. Should I call her the saint? Should I call her Teresa?
I think that's kind of the crux of the problem, isn't it? I mean, nobody knew, even I think she herself, nobody knew who or what she was. And she struggled with that, I think, her whole life. You know, I was telling you back in the green room, this is my Lady Gaga book, you know, in that she came here and became a pop star. She was not prepared to be a pop idol. You know, she was lucky there was no MTV back then. And how do you hang on to God, and how do you hang on to your tribal affiliations and even Mexico when you're in Manhattan, you know, being photographed 50 times a day. It's just, it's really a strange task she had for herself. But, you know, people call her La Santa. They call her Teresita. Most everybody just calls her Teresita. She's yeah. And I think she's a very personal, even though she's been gone so long, people have a very personal relationship with her still. She might be here right now, for all we know.
So can I ask for a show of hands who knows Teresita from The Hummingbird's Daughter? Okay.
Esa es mi gente. Oh, come okay. on. You can't tear that out yet.
Yeah, okay. By mistake. So she was a young girl then, but she's about 19.
She was 19 when she came across and then had to grow up here.
And so when she was, so in The Hummingbird's Daughter, she is a healer. She's a bastard child who gets brought into the big house, basically. She's brave. She's sometimes foolish, but always with like a real kind of braveness to her. I mean, she's politicized. And then she gets to America, and she just wants to be a teenager. And sometimes I'm not sure if Lady Gaga wanted to be a teenager.
Well, I think she's all those things still. She heals all through the book. She's involved deeply in the birth of the Mexican Revolution. She's brave, you know, she's a fighter. But she's also, you know, you've got to understand that in Hummingbird's Daughter, not only did she lose her tribe, she lost her teacher. She lost her home. She was tortured in prison, was going to be executed, was cast out. She went through that hideous experience, which people still don't know to this day if it was rape, beating, what happened that put her in a near-death experience. That's a lot of stuff for a young woman to go through, aside from massive fame and this incendiary God experience, and culminating in the massacre of her followers. 300 people are massacred. And it happened, interestingly enough, the Temochik massacre happened the same year that we had the Wounded Knee massacre up here. And I don't think they were disconnected. We don't pay attention to indigenous history, unfortunately, in either country. And so all of those things played out. So she got here, and she was still trying very hard to be a servant, I think, of God. But I think, you know, you can't discount the exhaustion and the outrage and the just, you know, I think there was a certain feeling of just, can't you leave me alone for a second? There are a couple of places where she prays to God, can you forget me? Can you take this away? Just leave me alone for a while.
And as they come to America, she and her father are trying to find their place in different ways. Tomas, is trying to find his footing sort of in the mode that he had at home, and constantly moves them sort of from place to place trying to find that. And she's trying to find sort of a new life.
I think so.
And it seems like what she really wants more than God is a boyfriend.
That's the urrea, you know. We're lovers, not fighters. I just think she wanted peace, and I think she, you know, holiness is not fun. Holiness is, you know, there's a section of the last book called The Catastrophe of Holiness. I wasn't kidding around. Saints, it's not a good job. And, you know, I think she was just yearning to be a person. I don't know about a boyfriend necessarily, but, you know, she lost her personhood in some ways very early. And it wasn't something she had asked for. I mean, it's one thing to, it seems to me that there's a whole lot of our Western culture that involves punishing women who step out of the mold. You see it over and over again in fiction, TV shows, movies. You know, women can do something extraordinary, but then they're going to get smacked down. It's every TV show, you know, it's just awful. And in some ways, that pattern happened to her. She studied. She was a precocious young midwife. She was an herbalist. She was doing all these things. She had chosen the sacred path, the medicine path. And then this horrible thing happened. And I think she refused to be beaten down by that, and she tried to overcome it. Then she came here. And we were talking in the green room earlier that it's one thing to live in the heart of your tribe and in the Mexican landscape in the 1800s, where you are the magic source. You become. She sort of inherited it from Huila, her teacher, and she became kind of she was going to be the head medicine woman, let's face it. Then she came here to the United States, where the United States was the source of magic. It was overwhelming. I was telling her backstage, I felt like the second book's a little bit of a science fiction novel. It's like 2001. She's gone to another planet, and it's way beyond anything she knows. So she's trying to find her way, and I think part of the story is even biblical in that, you know, there are all these distractions. She's maybe a prodigal daughter. Things keep happening that seduce you or confuse you, because that's what happens to all of us. But the whole time, I think she holds on to this thread of desire to do good and desire to be loyal to the things she is. But sometimes you forget who you are.
And I think it's one of the things that's interesting is the complexity of how she sort of moves through the world as she encounters one difficulty after another, or dates the wrong guy.
yeah, he was really the wrong guy.
He was really the wrong
guy.
He was. If he shows up on your doorstep with a gun, don't go with him.
don't
go with him.
But this is, again, this is something right out of a Mexican corrido, though. You know, this is passion. I have come for my woman, and you're not going to stop me, cabrón. You know, it was one of these big scenes that you can turn on any telenovela, and sooner or later, that scene's going to show up. Ya llegué, me llevo la mujer. Usted no lleva esta mujer. Sí, aquí tengo el rifle. You know, there's this, it's sort of almost a folkloric scene. What's weird is it really happened. And what's weird is she really went with the guy with the gun. And you're so right. If you'd only been there and said, not a good idea. That's just not a
good... Tomas tried.
That ain't a good courting move, showing up with a gun. Tomas tried.
I think that we're accustomed to the idea of, like, if someone has a spiritual calling, that it's very... The Western tradition, going back to Christ, is, you know, you just go with it. You sacrifice yourself, you know. Done. You're out of here. Through, like, Mother Teresa. That's the narrative. But she doesn't succumb to that. She fights and to be a person and to be a modern person.
You know, even Jesus prayed, take this cup away from me. I good idea, God, but find somebody else to do it, right? So that's, you know, I think it's it's a classic struggle for anybody who is spiritual, especially in a world that is not necessarily attuned to spirituality. And, you know, there's a whole difference, I think, too, in how do I put this? Hummingbird especially taught me, I didn't know going in, but Hummingbird taught me that there's a kind of a matrix of sacredness in the world. And I don't care what your denomination is or your faith or your religion, but there is a kind of sacredness that's bedrock and real, and it's here. And, you know, a lot of indigenous people know it well. And people forget that that's at base what she truly was. And, you know, when I talk to people, reservation people or Yaqui people or you know, they understand her story on a very profound level because it's very vivid to them. And when I was first starting the first book, do you know Linda Hogan, the writer Linda Hogan, Chickasaw poet and novelist? She was one of my teachers in grad school. And I had been doing research for a while, and I was ready to start writing. And I went to her office, and I told her the whole story, right? And I said, this is my story. And she said, that's great. And I said, well, do you want to write it? And she said, why should I write it? And I said, well, it's a woman's story. She said, so what? It's your woman. It's your responsibility. She said, don't you know medicine passes down the blood on the woman's side? She said, you're stuck. And I said, well, Linda, look, here's the deal. I said, my Western mind can't fathom all this stuff. She said, like what? You know, all of it, the talking plants and blah, blah, blah. I said, and this is what she said to me. I've never forgotten it. She said, honey, the Western mind is a fever. It will pass. And then she said something really wise to me. She said, you knew everything in this story as a little boy. You were raised there, and your family knew it, and your godparents healed you with herbs, and you saw miracles, because she knew my life story. She said, you forgot because you went to college. Now you're going to remember that you were wise as a little boy. And I thought, wow, you know, that's really cool. So I think the beauty of this is that sacredness is about real life. It's not about vestments and big gold hats and, you know, it's not about that. And I've told this story before, but my wife, when we first got together, I gave her the first draft and I said, how do you like it of Hummingbird? And
that was your first date?
No, not my first date. No, I gave her the first draft, I said. Wouldn't that be a first date? Hey, here, read Hummingbird's Daughter. We can go out. And she didn't like it. And I was like, what do you mean you don't like it? I thought, that's it for us. But she said I was trying to convert her instead of telling her a story. I was like trying to force her to feel awe. And I realized that's true after a while. I mean, you know, I planned suicide and stuff, but then I got over it. But it was true that I realized that what's powerful is story. And I made this formula, humorous formula for myself, which was this. In every place in these books where I tried to have the Mormon Tabernacle Choir show up singing a big, you know, I had to replace that with James Brown. Right? It's got to be funky. Mr. Brown was, in his own way, sacred as heck, you know, because we don't live up on the mountaintop in the rays of sunlight. We live down in the valley, right? And the people in these books lived lives of total discomfort, heat, mud, funk, work. And I thought, if you can find the sacredness there, down there, that's where it's really at.
Your details are so visceral and bring so many sort of physical aspects to life. One of the most joyful parts of your book is books are the food. I mean, like, I had to keep putting this down to go eat.
I went on a diet for this tour, by the way. Yeah, food. Well, food's sacred. Cooking is sacred. I think people forget when you're making food, you're involved in a ritual. And it's a ritual of love because you're going to feed somebody, even if it's yourself. And it's prayer. And cooking is prayer. And feeding your family or your friends or your lover or yourself is prayer. And so, yeah, and I was lucky enough to grow up around these crazy people who would cook this stuff, you know, and I was like, dang, that's awesome. And so it's a very, I want to make us reconnect with this. We get this for a short while. I think we're not this, you know. We're not this. This is the car we drive around. Some of us got a BMW, some of us got a Yugo, but we still, it's what we got to drive. But I want us to, I want myself to be happy to be here physically and to love this, because I'm going to lose it one of these days. Who knows what will happen then? And so if you can have spirituality and, you know, a praise in the sensual details, not a tawdry sensuality necessarily, but that sense of praise that we're here, that's really magic to me. And I think the food stuff in those books is magic in those ways too. And I know that when you're poor, because I was poor, a good meal, it's a big, big deal.
And it's there in the physicality of the Southwest and the heat and the dust. and I wonder, as a writer, as a man who's working, I'm guessing maybe at a laptop or a computer, typing in a room someplace.
Two fingers, man.
You must type really fast for two fingers.
Yes.
What is it that you do to remind yourself of the physicality or the sensuality? Because the thing that you're doing, as Barton Fink says so terribly, is the life. It's the life of the mind.
The life of the mind.
I'll show you.
John Goodman. I'll show you the life of the mind.
But this is the life of the mind, and you're connecting sort of the life, the spirit, and the physical moment of being here, but through the life of the mind. And how do you brew those things together, just even as a working practice?
You know, I get into this trance. I write myself into a trance, and then I'm not there anymore. You can ask Cindy. If somebody comes upstairs to try to talk to me, I'm just stricken. I don't even think I understand English. I look at them, my hair's like this. Huh? You know, I'm gone. So in some ways, I am in those places, I think, when I write. I also consider writing as part of my sort of spiritual discipline, you know, my writing foo that I practice. So I'm always in touch with that stuff, I think, when it's going right. And then just, you know, physically, I like to write to music. I'll often have candles going, and I have a Nepal cactus on my desk right in front of me. I can sit and ponder it. I'm right in the desert when I see it. You know, whatever works, those physical details are present with me. And if it doesn't feel present, I don't continue the story. I chuck it.
But research has also been a big part of your work. You've written nonfiction as well, and you spent a lot of time, we say 20 years, working on Hummingbird and Queen of America.
26 years for the whole thing.
So,
out of my mind.
How much of that was for Queen of America? Like, since doing Hummingbird, did you go back out in the field? Were there things that you wanted to chase down?
No. The thing is, you collect so much material. And when I realized that it was going to end where it did, there are still, you know, shelves of stuff that I had already collected. That being said, I did go out for more stuff. I went down, you know, I went to Texas Tech, where they have this incredible archive, oddly, of Teresita stuff, because they house the archives of William Curry Holden, who wrote the first really big Teresita book called Teresita. And you go into his archives, he has 100 family photographs. And he has this voluminous correspondence. And, you know, we were talking about descendants of Teresitas, you know, like her granddaughters. We've been in touch. Cousin Jean, I don't even know, she may be here. She's in this area. Anne is in Phoenix. Tomas Urrea and Gabriela Cantua, their children are in Texas. They're in Austin and San Antonio. The Loreto Tomas bunch from the Alamos area, their descendants are in Salt Lake City. And the brother's named Tomas Urrea, which is kind of cool. So that's really interesting. There's all that stuff going on, too. So,
And how much of this is real? How much of Teresita is real? And as a novelist, when you decided to take on a historical novel,
yeah,
this long dead lady who's some sort of weird old, some relative of yours, we're gonna say she's a tía.
Es mi tía, right? Every older woman in your family is tu tía. Ahí viene tía Cuca. Ahí viene la tía Blanca. Está la tía Negra. You're like, man, I've got like 78 tías. she's a cousin of some sort, actually. But what were you asking me?
you're starting from a real place.
Oh, yes. Right.
In Hummingbird, I imagine there was less sort of documentation, because what happens in Queen of America is that she comes to America,
yes,
and eventually her healing starts to grow in repute, and she goes from city to city, and then is even taken under the wing of some people who think that it would be nice to turn
make
her
a
into
buck.
Lady Gaga.
So how much is real? I've told this before, so if you saw me on tour with Hummingbird, forgive me for repeating it, but when I turned in the manuscript, it was about 870 pages in type. And my editor, who's fabulous, started hacking it. He likes that red ink. You know. And I was looking at it, and I basically was like, what are you doing, man? He said, well, I'm trimming it down. I said, well, what are you trimming? He said, well, it's a historical novel. It's taking out a little of the woo-woo stuff. And I said, man, the woo-woo stuff is the historical stuff. I said, I made up the stuff like what they ate in war. I don't know. But the other stuff is all eyewitness stuff. And, you know.
You mean the healing?
The healings, yep.
And her, whatever it was that happened to her, the mishap, the rape in the
There are,
book.
Yeah, yeah. she was such a catalyst that the Diaz regime in Mexico was terrified that she was going to ignite the revolution. She'd already helped ignite Indian warfare, and they didn't know what to do with her. They were going to kill her, and then they realized if they killed her, that's it. That's why she came to America. It was easier to send her away. But that being said, she was the focus of so much attention in both halves of her life that she had army reports about her, historians watching her. She had angry Catholic things written about her by priests making reports from the field. She had a lot of newspaper coverage, New York Times, LA Times. You know, she had...
I'm sure we wrote crazy stuff.
No, it was good stuff. It was good journalism, but... I mean, she was covered in Ohio. She was covered in Indiana. She, you know, she was known in Scotland. I mean, it's amazing to think that this child got this much attention. But a couple of things happened, and one of those things was, I hate to say this, but you know this is true, she was a woman. And the Mexican historians were like, whatever. She was an Indian woman, so she was even more marginalized by those guys. There's a piece of Mexican history where the guy pretty much outright states that her upwellings of wonders were due to hormonal enthusiasms. You know, it's a polite way of saying this was all PMS, the whole thing, which really outraged me. The other thing is, like, Huila, for example, real person, a real teacher, who, because she was an indigenous woman, only a medicine woman, only a maid or cook on the ranch, was completely ignored by the historical record except that she existed. All that was part of it, and the next thing that was part of it was the actual revolution happened. She died, and the revolution began. And, you know, there was that great book about the revolution called The Wind That Swept Mexico. It really was a wind that in some ways swept her aside. There was no time for folk saints when something like the Mexican Revolution happened. Then after the revolution, she was forgotten. And Lauro Aguirre, bless his heart, kept her flame alive and kept publishing about her. And there was a writer from Sinaloa named José Valadez, who was an old school, you know, Russian Revolution communist.
Trotskyite.
Yeah, exactly, a Trotskyite. And so he wrote a good communist version of her as a, you know, people's hero. And Lauro Aguirre published it, and they sort of brought her back. So part of my task was going and finding all this stuff that had been knocked asunder, which is, you know, in old archives and took a really long time. But, you know, so all that's true. Now, Huila, who's been one of the most popular characters I think he ever wrote, I'll tell you a brief story so you can see how real, I mean, a novel is a novel. In the acknowledgments in this book, I say the first line is, the story is not the history. This is my dream of the story. That being said, it's all the stuff that happened, all in line except one thing, which I moved her misadventure in Los Angeles in the storyline because it just made better sense as a novel. But she did come here and get in trouble. She got in trouble everywhere. So Huila, I went to Tucson to work on the book. I thought if I'm going to write about Yaqui people, I better go hang out around Yaqui people, right? It just makes stands to reason. And I got to Tucson, and there'd been a piece about a reading I did in the paper, and I didn't know I had relatives there. Okay, I didn't know. Descendants of Teresita, of her family. And my phone rang one day. And I answered the phone, and this woman says, Luis Urrea? And I said, yes. And she said, oh, I'm your cousin, Esperanza Urrea. I said, really? She said, oh, yes. She said, I am Mayo, and I'm married to the Herreras family, Yaquis. We live on the south side of Tucson. I'm the granddaughter of Maclovia Borbón Moroyoki, the medicine woman, El Jupa de Sonora. And in our tribal tradition, the eldest daughter is given to the grandmother, and grandmother raises her. So I was raised to be a medicine woman. I was thinking, damn, you know? I was like, yeah, well, how can I help you? She said, well, I just wanted you to know something, Luis. She said, in heaven, before we were born, you and I were identical twins. I was like, she said, God decided as a test when we came to the earth to separate us. I've been seeking you for 43 years, mijo. Now I found you. Now here's the kicker for me. The next line was, wanna come to a party?
You're like, we are related.
I know, right? I'm like, dang. So right there's the beginning of the tone of Hummingbird's Daughter. I thought, you know, that's funny as heck. And so when I'm writing the book, she was kind of coaching me, and she's the one who taught me feeling the life force in plants. She taught me a lot of interesting stuff. But I was complaining about Wila. Wila has been expunged from the record. There's no trace of Wila. And she said, you know what my grandmother would say about that? And she'd tell me this thing Maclovia did, and I'd be like, that is so funny. Yeah. And I, you know, next day, I can't write Wila. And she'd say, pues Maclovia would say, whom? And she'd tell me Maclovia. And I realized, I'm a little dense, that after about a month of this, she was trying to tell me Maclovia is from the same village, one generation later, full medicine woman. Pay attention. This is how Wila taught. And so whenever you read Wila stuff, it's actually grandmother Maclovia. And that was a very powerful thing. It was a very crazily transformative thing. And, you know, her pre-feminist warrior woman attitude was so refreshing and exciting to me and funny. Anyway, when I left Tucson, Esperanza came and she gave me Maclovia's rebozo. I have it. It's a yellow rebozo. It's in the novel as Wila's rebozo. And then
Teresita's rebozo.
Exactly. Yeah, it passes on. I took it with me. So Esperanza called me one day and she said, mijo, I've been really lonesome lately. And I said, why? And she said, you know, Maclovia died in 1963. And ever since then, she's lived with me, you know. She's helped me in my work and my healings. She's always been with me. She's gone. I said, well, what the heck? What'd you do to make her mad? She said, no, mijo, she moved into your house. She's helping you write the book. What are you going to do? So, you know, I think everything in the book, as deeply as I could make it, is real. The historical details are all in line. That being said, I could have written a textbook with footnotes, but I often tell people you can't footnote a dream, and that's the truth. You know, I entered into a dream of Teresita's life. And that's no joke. I mean, one of the things about hanging with medicine people and shamans is they do stuff like that. I'm going to make you dream. I'd be like, what? Yeah, 6 days from now, you're going to have a dream. Call me up, tell me what happens. Well, this guy's crazy, you know? And I'd have the dream.
We're going to see if there are any questions in the audience. If you have a question, please raise your hand. We've got some.
What is it about the Mexican Revolution that still holds our imagination as opposed to, say, the War of Independence? Why that revolution?
You know, I don't know. Maybe it was all those Sergio Leone westerns that got us turned. I think it was so tumultuous, and I think it was a revolution that never really ended. I think it was co-opted, and it was a cataclysm, all that. And I think it was very recent. All those reasons, I think, you know. But anything that gave us somebody like Emiliano Zapata also is something that we need to still process. So I think it's all those things. And I think it's still playing out in weird ways, even today. I think one of the fears in Mexico is that it's going to light back up again. You know, people are going to say, let's finish this. I think. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you think it has to do with money, with poverty, with people who have and who don't have? There are a lot of poor people in this book.
Yeah, well, my heart is with the poor people. I mean, I'm gracias. And you can buy my book. Oh, I should be giving it away, but
But you know what? You can take it out from the library.
Yeah, that's right. you know, I my own journey is a really weird one. And you may understand a lot about why I write what I write from this. But, you know, I come from Tijuana. Everybody knows that. It does my heart good. Now, wherever I go, I open every single talk with Tijuana in the house, because I know they've never had a Tijuana author. Yeah. Everything they told me, don't tell people because it's shameful. I'm like, screw that. It's not shameful. They told me my whole life, don't tell people you're from Tijuana, mijo. Come on. It's embarrassing. I've said, no, it's not. Rampa Independencia. You know, I love it. And they always tell people, don't tell them we were poor. It's shameful. I said, screw that also. It's not shameful. People sometimes don't have what other people have. We weren't poor. We just didn't have money. Third, they tell them, don't tell them you had tuberculosis. I was dying of tuberculosis, all right? My whole barrio, La Independencia, was dying of freaking tuberculosis, and so was I. What's the shame? That's just a story. And here I am, you know? Here we are. I think it's all stuff that is powerful and good later. Now, you know, La Rampa in those days, it was not paved. It was a dirt street. It was rough. And like I said, people were dying and all this. But we were doing okay. And I had my tia Flaca, tia Leti, la Flaca. And Flaca was this very powerful woman who really had suffered. And I learned something in Mexico, that a lot of times people who've suffered don't necessarily have a warm heart to people who are suffering behind them. You'd think, you know, you've been in hell, so put your hand out and help somebody else. And we went, this is a transformative moment in my life. Changed everything, I think. We went downtown to eat. It's La Flaca, my dad, and La Flaca's daughter, my cousin Margo. And we were walking in, and we were going to go have chicken. You know, nice rotisserie chicken, you know, with tortillas. And there was a woman with a little child, probably Mixteca, Indian woman, what they call a María, standing by the door. And we walked by, and she asked for alms. Por favor, tenemos hambre. And my tía Flaca, this fast, turned around and said, ¡Lárgate, perra! Boom, and kicked her. Get lost, you dog. Boom, kicked this woman and went inside. I had never seen anything like that. And it was the first time I even understood that there was poverty, really poverty, when I saw that. And I was shaken to my boots. I was a little guy, maybe 7. And we went inside, and I couldn't eat. And they were eating. They were having a great time. And I noticed that stinking Margo was taking her food. When her mom wasn't looking, she was pulling it off her plate into her napkin. And she excused herself, and she took her whole chicken out to that woman and gave it to her so her mom wouldn't see her. I've never shaken that moment. I've always remembered that moment. You probably know, most of you know, but when I was in college, my father was killed by the Mexican cops in San Luis Rio Colorado. And I didn't know what to do with myself when I graduated from college. So I went to work in Tijuana with these relief workers, basically Baptist missionaries. I don't know how that happened. But so I spent, you know, not only am I, you know, the author from Tijuana, but you know, I can proudly say I'm the only author at any book festival who started his literary career at the Tijuana garbage dump. But that's what I did. And I love those people, you know. And I understood that just by the slightest accident, we weren't those people. And when people hear, oh, you were born in Tijuana, they think, boy, that dude's got some street cred. But, you know, I wasn't born at the garbage dump. If I'd had my choice, I'd have been born up here in Beverly Hills, but I didn't get to choose that. Apparently Esperanza knows that we were sent here as a test to find each other. But, you know, and so there, my heart is there. It always has been there. You know, the reluctance of the U.S. Border Patrol when I did Devil's Highway was precisely that. They were like, this dude's some kind of beaner dude that writes books about Mexican poor people. We're not letting him in. And they finally did. You know, so that's, I make no bones about it. So yeah, there are a lot of poor people because that's the world she came from and that's who she came to help. I mean, one of the ironies is she ended up helping rich people in New York City. She was hanging with the Vanderbilts and all these people because they wanted their backs rubbed, you know, and they had, but they had their own problems and she, she learned, I think, like I did. I used to have terrible rage, class rage, anger. Oh, eat the rich. Talking about Lemmy. You know, Lemmy from Motorhead, he's got a great song called Eat the Rich. Take a bite of that son of a bitch. I was that way, too.
This is exactly where you thought the conversation was going to go, right?
You don't know how profound we really are, but I had to understand something, and that is that I don't care who you are. I don't care how astonishing your life seems to me. I don't care if you're in the 1% or the 0.1%. Everybody has got a Tijuana garbage dump experience in their lives. Everybody. Everybody. It may have been, you know, with pink, beautifully coiffed poodles around you, but you've still been through something that is heart-shattering. And that's just humanity. And, you know, that's where we all meet each other, I think. So it doesn't hurt people to think about the poor.
Teresita thinks about them all the time.
Yeah, she can't shake it.
They're also following her by the hundreds.
Yeah, it's hard to forget when they're standing outside your house looking at you. But you know, we deal with this in our own family. You know, people who I've known from the Tijuana garbage dump. I mean, you can kill yourself trying to take care of everybody. You can't. Bono has this great line, I can't change the world, I can change the world in me. I mean, if anybody can change the world, maybe it's Bono. But you know, you have to take a stand. You have to understand what you can and can't do. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I think I fled Tijuana, ultimately. I was just a kid who was seeing death and savagery and sorrow and hopelessness over and over, and there was no way to express it. You know, my friends were all guitarists and rock guys, and we would gather at this all-night donut shop, and they'd been doing their music stuff, and I'd been down there in the dump. And they're going on and on about their gig, and I'm thinking, I saw a burned-up child today. How do you say that over your, you know, apple fritters? Hey, I saw this kid got burned up with kerosene today. Dead silence, you know, crickets. There's no way to share it. And holding it inside yourself, I think, kills you. So that was another, I think, impetus to write. You know, a lot of poetry and stuff came out of those experiences. So,
questions from you guys?
Do you have plans for, are you writing on the next piece, or is it fiction, nonfiction?
Why, I'm always writing. I'm doing everything right now. It's awesome. I feel like I graduated high school or something. Longest high school on the planet.
Are you following him on Twitter? You can keep up
with him. Yes, I'm on Twitter. Urealism. I'm on Facebook. I'm easy to find, but I'm writing a lot lately when I'm not doing this. I'm doing this more than anything, so I'm trying to make time to write. But I'm starting a column at Orion Magazine called The Wastelander. That's coming out starting January. That's fun because I get to do nonfiction stuff. I just put an essay in Ziziva, the West Coast Lit Mag, so I'm happy about that. I've been doing stories. I accidentally won an Edgar Award last year.
Congratulations.
It was the most embarrassing moment. I thought it'd feel great. It felt horrible because I was just goofing off, you know, trying to write a neat story, and they gave me the Edgar, and I thought, wait, I've got to get up in front of all my heroes now and take this award? It was kind of weird, but I've been doing really well with those. I like those. I'm working on a novel right now, big novel based on World War II, inspired by my mother's adventures in World War II. She was a Red Cross woman, but not a nurse. She was a Clubmobile lady. I don't know if you know them. She was the party.
No. What was the Clubmobile?
The Clubmobile was what later was called Donut Dollies. And these were women who went to the front lines of battle and made coffee and donuts for the GIs under unbelievable risk. And nobody knows about them anymore. And, you know, I was thinking about how we love the Band of Brothers, and I thought, well, wait a minute, there's a Band of Sisters, too. And, you know, because of Hummingbird, I kind of accidentally, I think, also seem to be known as the guy who writes about women. So I thought, okay, if I write about women, what the hell, I'll get one more woman book out there before I move over to guy stuff. But, you know, I just think about this, my mom, and I think about how we all have these moms that, we, all of our parents, we don't necessarily understand what they are and what they've done and how stunning it is. Because I'm seeing it myself. You know, I'm kind of boring. It's like, oh, yeah, he wants me to take out the trash again. Whatever. I think, you know, I go out here and meet strangers all day long. They think I'm fascinating. You kids don't. And I thought, but my mom, you know, I just thought, well, it's just my silly mother. And here's this woman who was under George S. Patton. She was on the front lines. I realized my mom won the Battle of the Bulge with a glazed donut in her hand instead of a gun. You know, my mother was at the liberation of Buchenwald, and my mother was almost killed in a horrible wounding during the war, and then that's forgotten. And all of her colleagues are forgotten. There's very little stuff about these women. So we together, my wife and I, have been researching it, collecting stuff, and we went down to New Orleans to the World War II Museum, and they actually had uniforms. I had seen my mom's uniform in pictures, but I didn't realize, because the pictures were black and white, what color it was. And they opened the boxes, and they know the women who wore it. And they're telling me, oh, yeah, she was blah, 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 you know. And then they have, away from the museum, it's the museum that Spielberg and Tom Hanks helped with after Private Ryan and all that. They have a warehouse about a quarter mile away, and they took us and opened it and let us crawl around Sherman tanks and Nazi staff cars and artillery, all these things that are from my mom's story, including the kind of truck that was made into a clubmobile, so I could get in it. That was incredible. So that's coming. It's going to be called Goodnight Irene, but it'll probably take me a while to get it all together.
So I was excited that you were coming to LA to do this, so I'm a little bit loud. And I was thinking about what you read and what excites you. So I was just wondering, if you taught a Chicana or Chicano literature class,
ay, ay, ay.
What would you assign?
Ya me fregaste,
who would you assign and why?
If I were doing a Chicano class right now? Well, you know, I was really kicked off in a lot of ways by Chicano writers especially. And I always think that we should give props to some of the ancestors, you know. For me, it was Alurista, you know, Alurista. Holy crap. When I read Nation Child Pluma Roja, I don't know if you've ever seen it, the original little red book, like printed in some guy's house or something. I had never seen anything like it, because this dude was code switching everything I was told you couldn't do. You couldn't mix Spanish and English. You can't do that. But they were both such high-level language. And then he started going a little crazy. Remember, then he'd have Spanish, English, and caló. Then he'd have Spanish, English, caló, and now what? And then the dude started putting, like, now what pictures. I couldn't read now what codexes. I didn't know what he was talking about, you know? He'd have a line in English, and then some caló, and then some now what, and then a rabbit. Like, that, of course, Rudy Anaya, of course. I'm still loyal to Lorna de Cervantes and Emplumada. So some of those older texts, but I'm really fascinated by the young generation. What I think young. To me, everybody's young now. But Rich Yáñez, I love, in El Paso. Manuel Muñoz, if you haven't read him, dealing with the, you know, the gay experience in the raza. It's fantastic. There's a poet in Florida who's just come out with a book. His name is S.J. Rivera, Santino Rivera. And he's writing like 1971 revolutionary poems. It's really kind of cool to see. There's so many. There's so many.
I'm glad I finally got to meet you. Yo también andaba con Pastor Vaughn ahí en TJ.
Oh, no. Really?
De veras.
Oh, my gosh. You worked with Vaughn, really?
Yeah.
Ay, qué bárbaro.
I know. Emmanuel Baptist Church in Claremont.
Holy
right?
cow, yeah, good old Emmanuel.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a way for me also to escape, and so it really resonated, that kind of experience that you were talking about, you know, thinking you're poor, and then you go and you see the people.
Oh, my God, no kidding. You get there and you think,
oh, yeah,
I need to revise this.
Yeah. Anyway, but my question is, you know, you're clearly very inspirational and passionate, and a writer who has come from a non-traditional background, a non-privileged background. So is that another part of your life? I mean, do you have an opportunity to work with young people and to inspire young people to tell their stories?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, my day job, of course, is professor. So just on the most basic level, I get to do that. But yeah, I do it as much as possible. I like to do outreach stuff as much as possible and service stuff. And for example, when The Devil's Highway came out, the first stop was at Denise Chavez's Border Book Festival in Las Cruces. And so Denise thought it'd be really cool for me to kick off my book tour down at the state prison. So off I go, you know, with all the felons. And we had the most fantastic time. You know, so as much as I can, I do. But you have to be careful because there's a certain grandstanding to that. You have to be careful. One thing I always loved about Vaughn, this guy Vaughn we're talking about is the man I used to work for. I was his translator for a lot of years. But, you know, like San Francisco had picked Hummingbird's Daughter as their all-city read. And it was fantastic and a lot of really cool stuff. But I told them, I asked them, do you have a women's prison? Well, yeah, we got a county jail for all women. I said, okay, I want to go see them, but I don't want reporters. You can't hype it. And I got the press to send books for everybody. And it was fantastic. Unfortunately, they still sent reporters. That was kind of ghastly. But the moments like that are incredible, you know. So I do that as much as possible. Yeah, I love it.
I think we're going to have one more question, and then after that, there will be book signing.
Thank you. So someone gave me your first book, and I read it, and I loved it. And then I figured something out about you, and that you taught at Harvard. And I thought, this book about Latin America and Harvard, right? And I see you now, and since your Mexican roots, of course, they're fairly obvious, but you're also pretty Anglo-looking at the same time, right? And your accent is not...
That's right, man.
Not effective.
Mexican CIA right here.
So I'm wondering, in your career trajectory, when did you become, at the very beginning, were you already a Mexican writer? And was that obvious as you go through graduate school and all the things that you could have left behind as a marvelous writer, you haven't. So what was it like? How were you perceived, and how did you then evolve in the way that you have to embrace and extol your background?
Thanks. That's really good. Yeah, you know, when I go out places where people don't know me, I like to start, aside from saying Tijuana in the house, I say Tijuana in the house to set up the next joke, which is, I have now come to answer your most burning literary question, which is, why do I look Irish? Because I figure if we start talking about race and identity and ethnicity right off the bat, which is so uncomfortable and scary, go a lot of ways. You know, oddly enough, my dad was the güerito. He was the blondie. His mom, my grandma, was named Guadalupe Murray. She's one of those Irish folks that came into Mexico. And the Urreas are Basques. Urrea means man of gold. We were the original illegal immigrants, the Spanish conquistadores. And, you know, that's something that's part of the legacy that I carry around, realizing these guys came to conquer. But, you know, I was born in Tijuana. Spanish was my first language. I grew up in the barrio. I had a strong Tijuana accent when I spoke English. And I didn't know anything was weird until I moved to a little white suburb, Claremont, San Diego. And I became a pepper belly, beaner, greaser, taco bender, all this weird crap I'd never heard. And I tell this story often, but in fifth grade, this kid told me I was a wetback greaser. And I thought, what the hell is that, man? And I honestly, you know what it is when you're a little child, I thought I had grease on my back. I did. And I thought, all those white dudes can see the grease on my back, man, you know? And I went home and told my dad about it, and he sort of helped me figure that out. And I think I learned at that age that not only were we subhuman in the eyes of our neighbors, but Tijuana was filthy, and people smoked cigarettes made of horse dung, and everybody was a whore. And my grandmother was bad, and hence I was bad, and I had grease on me. It freaked me out. And I realized that I looked Irish. and that the people in my neighborhood couldn't recognize Luis Alberto Urrea as a Spanish name. They called me Luis. And I thought, well, hell yeah, call me whatever you want. Just don't call me greaser. And so I think by a process of alchemy, I just became Louis. Hey, Lou. Hey, how you doing? My accent disappeared. And I think that got me through grade school as I was trying to figure out what the hell's going on, you know? Junior high school, people would say to me later, I thought you was French. They couldn't say Urrea, so they'd call me Unreal. I was Louis Unreal. I could be a rapper, man. Louis Unreal. So that happened. And in high school, when I started getting a little older and I got my sea legs under me a little bit and felt a little more secure, it was a little freer to start coming back. But I think the real blessing to me was to go to college. Because suddenly I was with a different bunch of people with a different level of discourse. And they knew Luis Alberto was Latino. And I had Spanish, Argentine, Mexican, Chicano, Chilean professors. And they started bringing me, you know, Gabriela Mistral and Alfonsina Storni and Neruda, and, you know, Horacio Quiroga.
Malcolm Lowry,
yeah, yeah. And so I think it all came back as a great relief in college, and I felt like I had been somewhere off on an island and I didn't even know it. Like, where did he go? Oh, here he is, he's back. So it was just a short period in there, I think, grade school and middle school, where I hid just to survive because I didn't know what was happening. I was overwhelmed. That term taco bender seems to be a specifically Southern California insult. I've mentioned it to people all over the country. They don't get it. But you know, the taco bender, right? My cousin Jaime would come up from Sinaloa, and one time somebody in Claremont called him a taco bender, and he said, oh yeah, you cheeseburger? Didn't work, but I thought, that's pretty good. So, you know, I think I realized on a really deep level that that's a tragedy. That's a death. That's a soul cancer to give in to those things. And, you know, people would always tell me this stuff about, you know, I'm colorblind. I don't care. And here's what they do. When people say that, they always say the same thing. I don't care if you're white, red, green, purple, polka dotted. I'm like, they start going to these really extreme levels of mania, you know. I don't care if you're fluorescent green with orange eyeball. I said, what is that? I don't understand what you're saying. So I started trying not to be colorblind and trying to be exquisitely aware of everybody's differences and celebrate them because they're beautiful, instead of making believe they don't exist, which means something bothers you about them. You know, that's so all of that stuff happened. And the last thing I want to say about that is I also naively go through my life thinking everybody's bilingual, everybody's bicultural, everybody knows what I'm talking about. Everybody listens to Caifanes and Café Tacuba. Everybody has the same experience as I do and made tortillas with their Nina, and they didn't. But I don't remember that. So I try to keep a forgiving sense about being here. And that means forgiving to myself. Because I think internalizing the harshness made me really harsh to myself for a long time. I don't want to do that anymore. So, yeah, I'm going to celebrate my roots. The really great thing is, now that I'm done with the Teresita project, I'm kind of free to, I can kind of lay my dad's legacy, I think, in a place of honor that I tried to make for it. And now I can talk about my mom's too. Because that's me too. Which is cool. I'm in fresh new territory, feeling around, you know, writing about New York. It feels cool.
And there's New York in this. So thank you very much, Luis Urrea. There will be book signing out there.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Allowed theme was composed by Larry Karish.